Let's consider we are now in Mark chapter 11, and we were kind of finished in the middle of the event of Jesus cleansing the temple there in Mark 11, verses 15 through 19. We didn't quite finish what was going on in that particular event. So let us read that passage again, and we can hopefully get some insight into what Jesus did here and what applications we can take from it. Oh, I see Letha's here, Rebecca and Pam are here, so that's wonderful. And hopefully there'll be others to join us shortly. And of course, I know Sam and Sarah are on the phone, and I think Art is as well. So whoever else may be here, thank you for being here. All right, so let's take a look at this passage again. Mark chapter 11, starting in verse 15. So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught, saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of thieves?" And the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him. For they feared him because all the people were astonished at his teaching. When evening had come, he went out of the city. Okay. So we had talked about earlier, let's pull that up. We had talked about the temple being cleansed here, the frequency of how often he cleansed the temple. We talked a little bit about that, and we concluded, or at least I concluded, that it happened twice, at least. The first time in John chapter 2, and the other times recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, here on this final week of Jesus's life. We understand that there's a bit of controversy here. Oh, Valerie's here. Hello, Valerie. We recognize there's a bit of controversy that's talked about here. You know, people tend to use this scripture to try to justify all kinds of ugliness towards one another and violence towards one another, and it's such a shame because you know, and we talked a little bit about it last time, because you know we see you know Sam brought up a good possibility of when we might want to use this kind of behavior in sort of a defense of ourselves, a physical defense of ourselves or of somebody else. And so there is that potential possibility. At the very least, though, we should always be careful of our motives to make sure that what we're doing is in fact in line with what Jesus would do. That in regard to our actions, yes, we need to be guarded. We need to be careful. You know, Jesus, I'm convinced Jesus didn't do this. Because he was just a spur of the moment unbridled anger episode. I don't think that's the case here. I think he saw what happened on Sunday, and he comes back on, well, what was this, Tuesday? On Monday. He comes back on Monday and he realizes, he spends all night praying and thinking about, very likely anyway, about what he's going to do in order to remedy the situation that's going on here. So it's not some kind of spur of the moment, unhinged action that he is engaged in. This is something that he thought was the best course of action for dealing with the activities that were going on here in the temple. Now, consider one of my guiding principles whenever I consider this particular action and similar actions to it. I consider Romans chapter 12, starting in verse 9, going through the rest. You know, there is a place for self-defense. There is a place for defending ourselves, but it's a different thing to consider vengeance. You know, vengeance is the main thing that's talked about here at the end of Romans chapter 12, and there's a fine line between vengeance and justice. And we see in Romans chapter 13 that, at least in the ideal case, the government is meant to dispense justice, the civil government. And so we should make room for that sort of thing, make room for the judgment of the Lord. And if the civil government fails in that kind of judgment, then we leave it up to God. That's his venue. That's his that's up to him. That's not up to us. So I, you know, just wanting to make sure we understand that as well. All right, so let's consider the sins that were committed in this particular thing. Whoops. Sins committed during this event here. So there were, I count that there are three things that Jesus is trying to prevent, trying to stop here. Three actions mentioned here again that Jesus was trying to put an end to. The first one is buying and selling in the temple. And we see in particular in verse 15 that doves are specifically mentioned here. Doves are specifically mentioned. And I think it's very significant, and we'll look at why in a little bit. Another one is money changing. And money changing being a forex, if you will, a foreign exchange, you know, changing out certain currency for another kind of currency, for the kind of currency that was used at the time. So money changing is something else he was trying to stop. And we see that in also in verse 15. We also see he's trying to stop carrying wares through the temple. And we see that in verse 16. And this is unique to Mark. Mark is the only account that mentions carrying wares through the temple. This is kind of an interesting thing that's being considered. So we'll look at each of these and try to consider what exactly is going on here, because some of it seems legitimate. And we'll look at that as we move on. So we can see exactly what is going on here, and then again, what application we might be able to take from it. All right, so when the Bible refers to the temple, especially in the New Testament, when the Bible refers to the temple, it's not always talking about the temple proper, the place where worship or at least where sacrifices are made. But it's also talking about the temple complex. And so that's what this next picture is about here. We see, I see there are two. I have two maps here, or two diagrams that I found on the temple and the temple complex. And the temple complex is this whole area that's under consideration here. This whole area is considered the temple complex. And of course, that huge building in the center is the temple proper, is the main temple where sacrifices and blood is sprinkled and things of that nature. Only priests were allowed into the temple, into the holy place, and once a year, the high priest is permitted into the most holy place that we see there. Again, that building houses both things, that central building there. And anyone, however, was allowed into the temple complex up to a point, up to a point. The court of the Gentiles, or this particular map calls it the Gentiles courtyard, is the big wide open area on either side of the temple. And you can see that this is where the Gentiles are permitted to be. And it extends up to a dividing line by the temple proper. We can see sort of this line surrounding the temple mount, if you will. And so we can see that there, and that the Gentiles were allowed up to that particular point. The temple proper we see here in this particular diagram is the second temple built by Ezra and Zerubbabel that we see in the book of Ezra being built, and Haggai and Zechariah are encouraging to people the people to build it, those particular prophets. Herod the Great, the same Herod who tried to kill Jesus as a baby, was a terrible person, and yet he still tried to build the temple up and extended the temple courtyard quite a bit. And part of the reason for that, it's hard to get into the mind of somebody like that, someone who's so wicked he would kill his own children because he thought they were trying to take the throne. Someone so wicked he would kill babies in Bethlehem just to prevent another king from showing up, building this temple complex. Well, Part of that may have been he may have changed over time. And maybe Sam knows the history a little bit better than I do on this part. Or maybe it's because he was just trying to make a name for himself, trying to build something that would outlast him. And that's what a lot of kings did back then, just sort of building up something like that. The activities that Jesus was condemning, or were, con yeah, Jesus was condemning, proper English. The activities that Jesus was condemning were taking place in the courtyard of the Gentiles. And some have suggested that it took place, and for you, it would be on the left corner, the left corner closer to you, in that particular area there. And I think I have another illustration here where that may have taken place. Here's another really good diagram of the temple complex, and it's a little bit, it shows things a little bit differently, but, and there's a whole lot of little words there that are pretty interesting that you probably cannot read, and I certainly can't unless I'm looking at my at the PowerPoint itself. But in any event, you see this temple complex. And there's a lot of activity going on around here, and you can see again that short wall that extended or that shows where the court of the Gentiles ended, and only Jews were permitted to enter. All right, I'm going to show myself again here. All right. So in this corner here, or this area where the money changing, the buying, the selling, the money changing, all these things happening, we can see them kind of happening in this particular area underneath this portico on the southern side of the temple. So which is on the left side for you. It's kind of hard to show in this diagram. But in the previous one, let's see if I can pull up the previous map again. In this one, the southern side is on the left. On the left. So there, that is the southern wall. Closer to you is the eastern wall. The one to your right would be the northern wall, and the one on the far side is the western wall, as the one that still exists today, or at least a portion of it, where Jews, many modern Jews today worship. So looking at this courtyard, this southern wall here is believed to be where where these events took place. So the thing is, though, buying, selling, and money changing, these are all necessary activities for the temple. They're necessary to engage in these things. So the issue isn't buying, selling, and money changing. So we'll see what the issue is here. The reason why buying and selling were necessary, well, not everyone who was traveling, because the festivals, especially the Passover and a couple others, were festivals that everyone who was able, every male Jew was had to go to Jerusalem for these three festivals during the year, and most of them diligently went to the Passover feast, or the time of the Passover. So there, this is what's going on right now. They're buying and selling, and they're traveling, and they can't carry an animal with them all that way to offer as a sacrifice in the upcoming observance of the Passover sacrifices. So they purchased what they needed at the temple, and this was perfectly normal. This is a normal thing they were supposed to do. Money changing, or again, foreign exchange, was also quite necessary. Everyone had to pay the temple tax. Even Jesus did this, and we see that is mentioned as needing to be done in Exodus chapter 30, verses 13 through 16, so this is the temple tax that was commanded. Matthew chapter 17, verses 24 through 27, actually shows Jesus paying this temple tax. Well, in a miraculous way, but he still did it. So the problem is the tax had to have been paid in shekels, This is the Jewish currency that they had. So the Roman money that many people had, and of course, many of them are in various parts of the Roman Empire as well. And so they had different currencies with them as well, but many of them had Roman money. They had to have them exchanged for shekels. So there is a reason for this particular thing. So if these two things were sanctioned and in fact necessary for temple activities to be engaged in, then why is Jesus flipping tables? Well, we see Jesus, he quotes from Isaiah chapter 56 and verse 7. Let's look at Mark 11 verse 17 again, because this is where he quotes it. Then he taught, saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of thieves?" So he quotes from Isaiah chapter 56 and verse 7, and it suggests that it was the location that was the issue. This is the location that these things were being practiced. See, they were conducting this business in the court of the Gentiles, and it would be a distraction to the Gentiles who are trying to worship. You see, they don't care that the Jews don't care that they might be disrupting the Gentiles' worship. They're not Gentiles, so why is that a big deal? Because it's for all nations. As Isaiah 56 and verse 7 says, "My house shall be called a nation," or called a house of prayer for all nations. And all nations, of course, we might be able to understand that to be all the Gentiles as well. And so this is meant for Gentiles. Even Gentiles are permitted to do this. And so we note that this is a distraction to the Gentiles trying to worship here. And that is something that Jesus just can't abide. It's a house of prayer, and yet you're distracting them with the money changing, with the buying and selling, and with the wares being carried to and fro throughout the temple. And we'll talk about that all those in a second. So this might also speak to the third issue that Jesus had that was going on. Again, the third issue being carrying wares throughout the temple. And again, we'll talk about that in a second. So Jesus, he again alludes to Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 11 when he calls this place a den of thieves, a den of thieves. So let me put that up. Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 11. And so in order to get that context, we could read Jeremiah chapter 7 verses 1 through 15. And I encourage you to read that to understand what is going on here. To read that passage perhaps on your own so that you can get some idea of what is being talked about. Jesus, he's alluding to that particular passage, and it suggests that there was some thievery involved, that people were being exploited. Perhaps the exchange rates were exploitative. If you've ever gone to a foreign exchange office or bank or whatnot, and you give a certain amount of money, you trust them, unless you're doing the calculations yourself, you trust them to give you the correct money in terms of the exchange rate. And so that wasn't what was going on here, very likely. They were being exploitative. And this thought is certainly bolstered by the explicit mention of doves. So I want you to consider doves here for a second. Doves are specifically mentioned in this passage as being what was bought and sold. Recall in our series that we had on Leviticus not too long ago, perhaps you recall that the doves were most often used for whom? Well, these were often used by the poor. The sacrifices of the poor were often turtle doves and pigeons. And so the doves that were being used here were very likely sold for much more than they were worth, and they were exploiting the poor people at this time. So that's a very real possibility. Jesus's mother Mary had cleansed herself after giving birth to him with doves, with the sacrifice of doves. We see that in Luke chapter 2 and verse 24, and we see that commanded there in Leviticus chapter 12 and verse 8. So, what we note here is that some people, just like his mother, and perhaps even his mother, were being exploited. You know, if that were the case, I might start flipping some tables too, upset that the poor people are being taken advantage of by this corrupt system that's going on. In the same context of Jeremiah, he writes of the destruction of the temple in Jeremiah chapter 7. This was something coming soon for this temple as well. We note that the destruction of the temple in Jeremiah's time was coming soon. It wasn't. He was writing around the time of, it was just a few, 20 at most years, 20 plus years that the temple was going to be destroyed by the time that Jeremiah was writing. And for this point, it would be about 40 years before the temple was to be destroyed that Jesus is writing about here, or that Jesus is flipping tables, doing all these things. So, to me, it certainly sounds like that what will soon happen to them, to the Jews here in the first century, what's about to happen to them in about 40 years. So, hopefully that makes sense. One of the sad things about doing this online is that I can't see if you're nodding or if you've got confused expressions on your face, but you have to let me know if this doesn't make sense. So I can hopefully go into more detail on something if I need to. Well, and that's why we have comments. So please comment if that's something that I need to elaborate on. Sam, did you have something?
Yeah. One of the things that we take for granted today is standardized currency. And, you know, you're talking about the money changers, but it wasn't just, you know, taking some money from, you know, say some Greek money and changing it to Roman money and changing it to shekels. It was literally weighing out the money because the process by which they made money was not uniform. There was a lot of shaving of the gold and silver off of coins. People would do. And one of the things you see a lot in the scriptures in the Old Testament is how much God, and sometimes you wonder, what is he talking about? He says, you know, all the weights in the bag belong to the Lord, and he loves a fair weight and a fair shekel. You see those comments lots of times in the Old Testament. And so what you had here was people who were cheating by having, you know, like, for instance, if they said, okay, well, you've got your gold pieces here, your copper pieces or whatever, and so I'm going to weigh them out because I don't, you know, I'm not going to trust that those are actually the right weight, but then I'd use a weight that was too heavy or too light to cheat the person. So even though the balance showed that they were equal, they in fact weren't equal. And so, you know, that's very likely a lot of the cheating that was going on here, given how much it's referred to in the rest of the scripture.
That's awesome. Thank you for that. And it reminds me of, again, our talk on Leviticus, when we looked at Leviticus chapter 19, that honest weights and measures are things that were essential, that were necessary. And we put that under the category of love your neighbor as yourself, because if you are not going to use honest weights and measures in this kind of situation, you are exploiting the those who are, in this case, most vulnerable, who can't really double check you to figure out if that's right. We also see one of my passages that I like to turn to when it comes to this sort of thing is Proverbs 11 and verse 1. Dishonest scales are an abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. So dishonest scales, things like that, they're an abomination. These people are in a den of thieves. They're stealing this sort of thing in terms of the money changing and selling these doves for prices that were, again, exploitative of the poor. Thank you, Sam, for that comment. I appreciate that. There is, of course, one more thing. Moving on to verse 16, there is one more thing that he prevented people from doing. And it says carrying wares through the temple. Now, what is it being talked about here? What's Jesus trying to stop? Well, as you might recall, the temple complex takes up a huge section of the city, and it's in the middle of town. So many people, it would seem, were treating this courtyard as kind of a shortcut to go from place to place, including carrying wares, or more literally, objects, things, vessels, or goods. And this was a concern in the Mishnah as well. And if you recall, the Mishnah is the traditions that were recorded by the Pharisees a century or two after the events of Jesus. But we see that they picked up on it too. They realized it was an issue, at least by that point. J.W. McGarvey, he comments that Jesus was not permitting them to carry any sack, he was not permitting them to carry any sack, bag, jug, pail, basket, parcel, or such like thing through the sacred enclosure. So that's what's going on here, and he's trying to stop them from doing that. It was no doubt a distraction to the Gentile worshipers as well, treating the area as common while the Gentiles were trying to be holy and focus on the Lord. And so that I think is what is what's going on here. We're going to consider the reaction now, but before we do, Sam, do you have any other thoughts or comments about that?
Yeah, I think the shortcut thing is really indicative of this. And, you know, because you think about it, what does it mean? So, yeah, someone cares so little about the temple of God that they'll go up into it for just to save themselves a few steps, right? That you could imagine, and even coming into the temple, you know, why would you want to carry something with you? You know, you're going to take something to market or something. Oh, I'm going to stop by the temple first, so I'll just drop in the temple and I'll just carry my stuff with me. See, the attitude there of not being wholly devoted to the action of going to the temple to worship God, and you know, whether it's in the court of the Gentiles or anywhere in that complex, the disregard for the holiness of the area and the intent to worship God, I think is part of the thing here.
Yeah. And so Jesus is preaching against that. He's saying, no, we got to concentrate. And so this is an amazing thing to consider with our own worship. And I don't exactly have this on my notes here, but just thinking about our own worship and how we need to be, as much as we can, free of distractions. Keep our phones away from ourselves. Now, I know those of you at worship who worship with us know I'm on my phone sometimes during worship, but that's because I'm doing the live stream and trying to make sure things are okay that way. But and many of us do use our phones and tablets and whatnot for the Bible. So that's not what I'm talking about. But, you know, sometimes we might play games or get on social media or something like that. And we really need to take ourselves out of that, turn that off, and focus on God. And you know what? That's true for, you know, I might be ruffling some feathers. That's true for children as well. You know, we don't allow our kids to have tablets or anything like that during worship because they need to realize that what's going on is something important. Now, we'll let them color and do things like that, or read a book, but that's a little bit different, isn't it, than having a tablet in front of you? Because tablets are so addictive and so distracting, and it's very different. So we just need time to sit in worship. We need time to sit to reflect on God, reflect on what He's done for us, and on how we can apply that to our lives. And we need that quiet time with just you and God, with just us and God, that quiet time together as we are worshiping our God together. And boy, that is so important for even back then, and it's important now. And, you know, we don't get that with a lot of contemporary worship today, do we? We, you know, they have bands playing, and they have all sorts of activities going on, and a lot of churches have hooting and hollering during their worship. Man, that's not, that's distracting, isn't it? We need to focus on God and look to Him for our, how we ought to worship. And we see that right here. And if we can apply that and understand this, we can know that when we have it quiet, when we have it free of distraction as much as we can, then we're in a much better position to worship our God in spirit and truth. And I hope that you agree with me on that. Thank you, Sam, for those comments. It really got me on a bit of a rabbit trail, but that's okay. It's very important for us. So the reaction, let's consider the reaction that that these people had. And I start off with a question. I start off with a question here. What would be your reaction if you had just seen this happening? Well, if you just saw this guy, and you might know who he is, you might not, but you see this guy just flipping tables all over the place, and he's over there teaching about the den of thieves and things like that. You might be able to hear him a little bit, but man, what would your reaction be? What would you be thinking? You might even be right there. And I think, honestly, it would depend on who you were for your reaction. But Sam, what do you think? What do you think your reaction might be during something like that?
I think the proximity is an interesting point you make, because as big as this place was, I mean, it was, you know, many football fields. I like the scale of a football field beside one of those diagrams. And so you could be 100 yards away easily. And it was a big area. There were lots and lots of people, probably thousands, in this temple area all the time. And so you'd hear a disturbance that was far away. You know, you wouldn't necessarily know. You say, well, what's going on over there? The other thing to remember is the Romans were in control of this area, and they were watching for disturbances as well. So, you know, you'd have all kinds of interesting thoughts. But watching it go on, it would definitely be unusual and alarming to people. And then if they recognized it was Jesus, they'd heard about Jesus. You know, they've been hearing about Jesus for a couple of years now. You know, what does this mean? What is he doing? And you can imagine the royal portico in your diagram there. It's probably where the upper class hung out. So, you know, the Sanhedrin members, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the leaders were probably in earshot of what was going on there too. So, you know, there's all kinds of people's different perspectives happening when this is going on.
Yeah, that's right. You know, one of the things that I notice is right in here, the reaction that we see in verse 18 of the people's reaction is that they are astonished at his teaching. And of course, his teaching was accompanied by action. And that action, of course, along with the teaching involved in there, was astonishing to these people. Now, that can be a very nebulous word, at least in Greek, to understand what do you mean by astonishing, like surprised in a good way or in a bad way or in a ghast way, like, oh my goodness, you just did this. I need to get away from here. You know, there are different ways in which we can interpret that. So what exactly is he talking about? So, this, what was going on here was not, well, his teaching, I should say, his teaching was a fairly common occurrence. And of course he taught all over the place. And so his teaching, in fact, I think, if I remember correctly, somewhere it says it was his custom to teach. And I'm trying to remember exactly where I read that. I'm sure it was fairly recently. You know, it's his custom in any place to teach where he was. So teaching was a fairly common occurrence. They weren't necessarily astonished at what he said, although they were, or the fact that, rather I should say, they weren't astonished at what he was, at the fact that he was talking, because teaching is an important thing. and it's something that he did often. In fact, it was his purpose, one of the things it says earlier in his purpose statements. But now he certainly had their attention after flipping some tables. And that causes astonishment. One of the first times we read about the astonishment of the people is when he casts out a demon in the synagogue. We see all the way back in Mark chapter 1. The people were astonished at this. But maybe many of the people, again, recognized the injustices that were going on, the things that, Jesus said. Jesus said that they were not treating this place as a house of prayer for all nations, that they were treating it instead as a den of thieves. Maybe other people recognize that as well. Maybe this wasn't a revelation to everybody, but to but they were still recognizing, man, that's right, this is a den of thieves. I'm glad somebody's trying to stop this thing. I'm so happy about that. You know, sometimes whenever I was teaching in high school, I didn't, you know, and I should have, but I didn't always punish the kids in a timely manner. And again, I should have. And whenever I did, many of the students around them and around at the time were grateful that the other person was just quiet for a minute or had been punished or had been taken care of. And so sometimes whenever someone is doing something wrong, other people are appreciative when they have been taken care of, when they have been dealt with. And so maybe that's the case here. They weren't quite sure how to handle the injustices going on, but they're happy that somebody had dealt with it. They were putting up with it because they didn't see an alternative. But in any event, he certainly garnered more of a following in the temple right under the noses of the elites, as Sam said. It was right under that portico. The guards, commentator talks about the guards, the temple guards. You know, there were temple guards. And so why didn't they do something about this? Why didn't they stop Jesus from doing this or arrest him or something of that nature? And he notes this, this particular commentator, Marty Kessler, notes this as apparently strange omission that, again, the temple guards aren't mentioned. So what about those temple guards? Why weren't they called to deal with Jesus? You know, maybe they too were astonished at his teachings and couldn't bring themselves to stop him or to arrest him. You know, this wouldn't have been the first time something like that happened. We see, you see on here in John chapter 7, verses 45 and 46, where indeed there was, they were going to arrest him and take him, but they were just astonished at what he was saying, and they just couldn't bring themselves to do it. The scribes and the chief priests' reactions, you know, they feared him because of the following he had amassed. He had garnered such a following that they were surprised at this. They weren't quite sure what to do. They also sought to destroy him. It says in verse 18, the chief priests, the scribes and the chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him. So again, it depends on who you are. The people were astonished, but they were afraid. They sought how to destroy them, perhaps more earnestly. You know, we saw all the way back in chapter 3 and verse 6 that they started to do that, but now they were really starting to work harder at it, to try to figure out what they could do. Perhaps, this is me trying to give the chief priests and the scribes the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't. Perhaps they had the best of intentions. Sam actually mentioned this a little bit earlier. The Romans were known to violently stamp out insurrection, and others had arisen to foment such rebellion against Roman occupation. And so maybe they thought, oh man, this guy, he might start a rebellion and we might earn the wrath of the Romans upon us. And we see that in several passages in John chapter 11, verses 47 through 50, where they're where the chief priests and whatnot confer among themselves, and because of this fact, because the Romans might try to stamp them out violently. But also in Acts chapter 5, verses 36 and 37, where Gamaliel mentions a few other people who had tried to do just that, who had tried to foment some kind of rebellion. But what's more likely, I think, in this context is that they were benefiting from the thievery and the exploitation of the people that Jesus had thrown out of the temple complex. I think they may have been benefiting from this, and they were upset about that. Man, we were taking a cut here, and now he has destroyed that. And so now we are trying to destroy him even more. He was a threat to their pocketbook. He was a threat to their power. And they were envious of him. They were jealous of him. We see in Mark chapter 15 and verse 10, in fact, that they were. In fact, the reason all this was happening was that they were jealous. For he knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of envy. They were envious of him. After all the way back again in chapter 3 and verse 6, they began to hatch a plan, a plot, if you will, to destroy Jesus with the Herodians. Now is when their plans would be kicked into high gear, being fulfilled before the week was out. But that evening, he returned to his lodging in Bethany, as we see in verse 19. And in a little while, the next day, we'll see in verse 27 through 33, we'll talk about that maybe next week, maybe the week after, we'll see that they had actually, that they were questioning his authority. You know, they weren't prepared to question his authority at the time. They waited until the next day when he arrived. And in fact, the moment he comes into the temple, it says early in the morning, we understand this to be perhaps around 6 o'clock or so in the morning when he comes into the temple, and they're questioning him like, "What? Who gives you the authority to do this?" And so we'll talk about that perhaps next week. But first, we've got to figure out what the lesson of the withered fig tree is that we talked about last week. And we'll talk about Mark chapter 11, verses 20 through 26 next time. So please join us for that. We are at time right now, 5:45, at least according to that clock. We'll see how accurate that is here. Yeah, just about that. So glad that you've all decided to join us today. We are going to start our evening worship in just a little bit, so stay tuned. We're going to start a new live stream for that. So if you will, keep refreshing this page or like this page or follow this page in order to see when that will happen. And if you're a member of the congregation here, you will get a link for that. So again, thank you so much for joining us, for being here with us. God bless you, and Lord willing, we'll see you in just a little bit. All right. Take care.